So this Advent, we're walking through these 4 weeks of preparing for Christmas by looking each week at a passage from the book of Isaiah. These are all magical passages. If they were fiction, they'd be in the fantasy section at Barnes & Noble. And in this particular Christmas season, in the midst of a country that is deeply divided, and in the midst of a time when it feels like many advances in basic human and civil rights that have been gained through blood, sweat, and tears over the last century are being defied by many. Hateful speech, once taboo, is being spoken shamelessly in the light of day. And threats of violence are being carried out openly against marginalized groups. And there's no longer an assumption that it will even be addressed or called out verbally by those in power, much less responded to decisively. Things feel like they are getting very real, as they say. So why do we be looking at fantasy this Advent, when the very real requires our urgent attention? And so I submit to you that this is actually exactly the right time to be looking at fantasy. Exactly the necessary time to dig deeper than ever for the keys to unlock the selves within us that can respond to these seemingly impossible circumstances. So yes, we're going magical this Advent with even a starry night background for the month. Last week we looked at swords being forged into plowshares and the Cleveland Browns winning big, though you had to be here for that one, I think. And I invited you to consider taking on the rereading, or the rewatching perhaps, of a favorite story of yours as an Advent disciplinarian. A story that captured your imagination, that helped you dream big, and helped you think about who you wanted to be and imagine yourself being that way, perhaps in the shoes of someone else's story. A story that helped you think about what kind of world might be possible. And what actions of yours might be possible in it. This week we're diving into an amazing Isaiah passage that's often referred to as the passage of the peaceful kingdom. It's another passage that has deeply inspired Mennonites, Quakers, and other historic peace churches. And one of the most famous depictions of the peaceable kingdom is by a Quaker painter in the 19th century, Edward Hicks. And when I really shouldn't say one of the most famous depictions, because he painted this passage more than 60 times in different ways of the scene described in Isaiah 11. I have a feeling that if I had a copy of this up here, many of you would find it familiar. It's a painting that's done and I did have art with Mary Lou in high school, and I'm probably going to describe American 19th century art horribly. But to me, when I see this painting, it reminds me of that era. The characters have a little bit of a stiff sense to them. And there's a lion, a wolf, and a leopard. And they're kind of looking at the camera, actually, so to speak, not the actual camera, but they're looking at the viewer, and they're sitting very formally and stiffly alongside these placid, cud-chewing livestock who are studiously avoiding the gaze of the viewer. And there are several fat white children scattered throughout, dressed in sort of Grecian white cloths. So it's an odd vision of utopia, both Isaiah's words and Hicks' depiction of them. My version of utopia would be somewhat different. For starters, I'd go much more politically correct with a title like A Peaceable Kingdom or Community, because hierarchy and patriarchy of kingdom chafe of it. But peace in this passage is not a vision of that kind of radical equality. This is a vision of individuals with radically different levels of power and privilege somehow cohabiting, with all those inequalities and differentials still in place. And Hicks' depiction suddenly seems quite realistic. these predators are looking so stunned and panicked into the camera because they still have all those instincts and appetites and histories, but they're trying desperately not to be hungry for the tasty morsels around them. I'm reminded more than anything of the, quote, vegetarian vampires of the once very popular young adult fantasy series Twilight. Trying to live nobly among humans, all the while desperately trying not to want to eat them. I'm curious, First Service may not be the place where anybody has read the Twilight series, but I would be curious if folks here have. The author of Twilight, Stephanie Meyer, even referenced this Isaiah passage in the first book when she describes the moment that her human heroine and vampire hero confess their love to each other for the first time. And so, the vampire says, the lion fell in love with the lamb. What a stupid lamb, says the human. What a sick, masochistic lion, replies the vampire. It's actually a pretty interesting perspective on the peaceable kingdom. Because isn't this much like the actual world in many ways? How can there be true peace in a world of such inequity? What does it mean to invite a sheep or a calf or a kid to a picnic with a lion or a leopard or a wolf? I'm reminded of a conversation about safe spaces that happened at a gathering of LGBTQ Mennonites a few years ago. And I've mentioned this before because I found it very interesting. But they acknowledged, those who were framing this gathering, that as much as we all would like it, no one can ever guarantee anyone else safety in any space. That we can work to lay the groundwork for safety, to make safety as likely as we can, but that ultimately what may seem like a safe space to a person with privilege and power is going to by necessity need to be a brave space for someone of less privilege or power to enter it. So it's something to think about in these days when more people are suddenly realizing the necessity of talking with one another and confronting deep-seated racism and sexism and homophobia, etc. And I think this is the time when white folks like me should be quiet and listen to people of color, for example, and straight folks listen to gay and queer folks, men listen to women and other genders, Christians to folks in other religious traditions, able-bodied folks listening to the differently abled. But any time a request is made for a marginalized person to share or educate, it may seem like a safe invitation with a safe intention to a safe, peaceable picnic. While it's requiring risk and courage for that person to show up, and it's a risk that's not often acknowledged. What does the lion have to lose in the peaceable kingdom? If order breaks down, the lion's gonna be fine anyway. Those with power and privilege can feel like as long as we intend to be safe people and issue safe invitations to safe places, that it will follow that we and our places and invitations are actually safe. For me, it's both the draw and the fear of the symbol of the safety pin being used as a symbol of safety to marginalized folks here and now in our country post-election. I love the desire to be safe and the willingness to proclaim it, and it makes me happy to see it on others. But along with the intention and the invitation has to come deep investment in what it means to actually be someone who can offer safety in some way. I say all this partly because it has been profoundly dismaying and humbling to me to realize just how inadequately enabled I am to provide safety even for my immediate family, whose blackness renders them profoundly vulnerable in our country right now. And I don't know how to leverage my privilege, and I know that I can be a poor ambassador into vulnerable places, naively believing that places that are safe to me must also be safe to them. And then finding out that I can't even see the ways in which places I insist are safe, in fact, don't feel safe to others. So while I admire the realism in the midst of Isaiah's fantasy that we must find peace even in the midst of inequity, Because if we wait for there to be no inequity before we attempt peace, we'll never get around to attempting it. It also depicts the reality that for peace to happen, the appetites and habits of the powerful will need to radically change in ways that will not feel comfortable, much like the stunned, restrained-looking predators looking into the viewer's eyes in Edward Hicks' paintings, doing their best to deny their natures and habits. But I think there's also a real lesson for those in privilege to step back and assess whether places and spaces that feel totally peaceful and safe to them actually are safe to others. And to acknowledge that any peace in the midst of inequity will be a fragile peace at best. So in the very same sentence that has these unlikely pairings of prey and predators, we find this phrase, "and a little child shall lead them." That part of that verse is actually the inspiration for this, the looking that we're doing this Advent, our theme being, "and a child shall lead them," waiting with the eyes of a child. You could say that it follows in the sequence of unlikely prey-predator pairings very well, because it too is so unlikely, allowing a child to lead. It's interesting, though, how in real life, children may sometimes be spoiled or indulged, but rarely, I think, do we give children chances to really exercise leadership and what that might look like, or to speak into it. And I'm not proud to say it, but I can be dismissive of my own kids, especially when they ask inconvenient questions or ask them at inconvenient times. So often I'm simply busy with something pressing at work, or I don't feel like thinking about that thing, whatever it is, or I don't want to admit I don't know the answer, or they really want to dive deeply into something and ask a myriad questions, and I want to skate on the surface. In other words, when I'm being dismissive of the children I'm closest to, it's usually not because they're not being insightful or helpful. It's because I've got my own agenda and I'm not open to suggestions. I'm not willing to be led by them off the mental track I was on, or to be led in a different direction in my plans. And I don't think I'm alone in this. I observe this not infrequently in other parents and other adults. It's interesting, though, that we adults, or many adults anyway, continue to read children's and young adult fiction quite voraciously well into our adulthood, a genre which often has the world literally being saved by a kid leading the adults, leading where no adult was wise or brave enough to go. Every single Scooby-Doo mystery ever was solved by those pesky meddling kids. Thinking also of Hunger Games, Divergent, The Chronicles of Narnia, Ender's Game, a lot of the books and series that I see our CMCL kids reading during sermons on Sunday mornings. When I was a young adult myself, it seemed eminently obvious, so much so that I never even questioned it, that of course a bunch of teens or preteens could save the world. And as I've moved into middle age, I've sometimes felt resentful about the lack of literary renderings of heroic middle-aged folks. Although I did read in preparation for this that the four hobbits in The Fellowship of the Rings were in their 30s at the start of the book, and Frodo was 50 when The Fellowship of the Rings actually set out. So I was like, yes, okay. There's some heroic middle-aged folks my age that I can read about, too. Although the movie really leads you off track with that, because they hire much younger actors for those roles. I continue to enjoy reading and watching young adult fiction, and have puzzled over why a 41-year-old is drawn to heroes and heroines much younger than myself, and wonder, is it wishful thinking, regrets over a childhood overly concerned with being the good girl, and so I'm just living vicariously through more, through fictional risk takers. But one of the young adult books that I enjoyed when I was younger and have reread since then is the book Ender's Game by Orson Scott Card. In the future that it imagines, humans have discovered an alien species, and this is a little bit of a spoiler. They had one war, and there was another impending one, and so they begin by training young children who they think have strategic and military capabilities. So Ender Wiggins, titular character, quickly stands out as having exceptional capabilities in these areas. And so all the time during the book, he's being trained with war games, only to discover at the very end of the book that while he had been playing in a virtual cockpit, he had been making decisions that were actually controlling the plans of actual soldiers, actual fighter planes, actual ships, actual adults flying the planes that he thought were pretend. And he leads the world to a great military victory, all the while thinking he was playing a game. And it got me to thinking, what if the message for adults in the phrase, "a child shall lead them," is about letting your imagination, the place where perhaps your inner child still resides the most fully, take the lead as far as, and then you bring your strength, your maturity, your knowledge, your wisdom, all of that willingly to bear under the leadership of your imagination. Allowing the innocence, the heart, the imagination of your inner child to lead with all those extraordinary capabilities that you have developed over the years. What if we brought all our gifts and capacities and skills to the service of our inner child in how we respond to the challenges of our world today? What does your inner child instinctively know? Might we not see solutions that our older selves would dismiss out of hand? And then there's following the lead of the actual children among us. What ideas and observations do they have that we might be missing? How might the adults of our congregation marshal ourselves to follow the lead and imagination of our children and youth? And to our children and youth, what are you impatiently, eagerly wishing that we'd ask for that you obviously know already in your instincts? There's a fascinating image of new life and hope at the very beginning of today's passage. It's the image of a new sprout growing out of a tree stump. Out of a solid but broken foundation, a new generation of a tree is taking over and starting anew. In the words of one commentator, what if we believe this fragile sign is God's beginning? Perhaps then we will tend the seedling in our hearts, the place where faith longs to break through the hardness of our disbelief. Do not wait for the tree to be full grown. God comes to us in this Advent time and invites us to move beyond counting the rings of the past. We may still want to sit on the stump for a while, and God will sit with us, but God will also keep nudging us. Look, look there on the stump. Do you see that green shoot growing? O come, green shoot of Jesse, free your people from despair and apathy. Forge justice for the poor and the meek. Grant safety for the young ones and the weak. Rejoice. Take heart and do not fear. God's chosen one, Emmanuel, draws near. And so I say today, let us be brave, not just promise safe spaces. Let us follow the children among us and the children within us. Let us tend the slender sprout that might even be growing from the stump of the future we thought we were building. This morning is a communion Sunday, and sometimes